So, tonight's talk is on a topic which kind of a traditional list, if you can take it. This is called the four nutrients, so the four foods talked about. And here in the West we have the saying, or maybe we don't like the saying, called we are what we eat. And so, I guess the Buddha said the same thing. But then he defined food a little bit differently than our literal meaning of edible foods. And so, the Buddha distinguished four different things which nourish and support our life. And the first is edible foods. The second is sense impressions. The sense impressions that come to our sense doors. The senses of seeing, touching, smelling, tasting and all that. The third is our intentions, our volition, the choices we make. And for Buddhism, that's a very important role. And it's so. And here you see in this list that it has a very important role. It's what supports and nourishes our life, our intentions. And the fourth is consciousness, awareness, the mind, in a sense. So these four. And so in thinking about these four foods, you have to realize that in Buddhism, the self, or who we are as an individual, our individual life, is not... It's not like this. You can't find this fixed thing, or this is who I am, that's permanent and stable. And it's what it is, in a sense, is the sense of individual life, individual self, is it's certainly not a physical process or material process, but it's a nutritional process. And what I mean by nutritional process is that it's a maintained process. It's a process that needs to be maintained. And if it's not maintained properly, things don't go so well. Life comes to an end if it's not maintained properly. So the self, the thing that we all grapple with when we look at Buddhist teachings, is not something in and of itself. And it's not something that's caused by anything else, but rather it's a maintained process. It's something that's maintained. And the idea that our life is a maintained process means that it has to be maintained regularly, like a maintenance, like you have to keep it up. It's kind of like house cleaning. You clean your house, and then what happens? You clean it again. Clean it again. And most of us, we might have the secret wish that you can clean your house once and for all, and that'd be good, and finished, and, you know, basta, and you live cleanly ever after. But most of us have come to terms with the fact that we have to clean our houses. Someone, I don't know who it was, some mother, maybe from our Sangha here, reported that her son went off to college, and wrote back or something after a few weeks or months in college and said, I didn't realize my clothes got dirty. So sometimes it's a surprise. So this is kind of bad news for some spiritual seekers. Because spiritual seekers sometimes, some of them have this idea that there's a kind of magic key. Like a magic thing you're going to understand, this is it, or experience is going to do it, or something you're going to, why do all this hard work of spiritual practice if something doesn't kind of click in and that's it, and it's done, and you can just relax, and nirvana is vacation. Happily ever after kind of idea of spiritual life. But I think a spiritual life is something that lasts a whole lifetime, a spiritual practice, it doesn't end. A spiritual practice is a maintained. Constantly, you know, cleaning shop in a sense. And part of what it means to maintain a healthy life force, a healthy sense of self, a healthy individual life, is to include the whole of it and not just parts of it. And I gave a talk on Saturday about the sacred. And by the end of the talk, I decided that the better word for Buddhists was, the word sacred doesn't work very well for Buddhists. And we shouldn't use it too much. The word holy works a lot better, because the word holy has the same root as the word whole. Whole as and health, So holy works real well. See, what doesn't work about sacred is the word sacred originally divides the world between that which is sacred and that which is profane. And the Buddhist experience is not an experience that's supposed to divide the world, but rather make it complete or include everything. So that's why I like the word holy. Now, in relationship to these four foods, what's interesting is that two of them could be said to be involved are physical aspects of our life, and two of them with what's more the mental side of our life. Our edible food and the sense impressions have more to do with physical experience, and the intent is more the mental side, the side of life, the cognitive side of life. And the fact that these are balanced, kind of two kinds of food for each types, suggests to me that a spiritual life is a balance between supporting and nourishing our physical side of our life and our mental side of our life. In Buddhism, these two are not separate. They're not hard and fast distinction between the two of them. But we can, look at them from two different points of view. And what we find is many of us here, probably isn't just here in the West, but many of us tend to, of our experience, certain things which we then say, this is the self, or this is who I am, this is acceptable, and other parts of ourselves we don't pay attention to, we numb out on, we don't include. One definition I came across recently for the self, and this is not supposed to be a talk on the self, is the self is the organizing principle of consciousness. It's the organizing principle of all the stuff that goes on within us. And if that's what it is, then you don't say, well, it's an organizing principle. It's not a thing then. It's, it changes depending on how you organize things. But we tend to organize the world, ourselves, the contents of our mind and our hearts. So certain things are acceptable and certain things are not. And when things are organized selectively, then it's not holistic, it's not whole, it's not holy. And part of the function of spiritual practice, I hope, is to fill out the picture so that there's a balance and all the pieces of ourselves are included in the whole. Now, one of the parts of ourselves that's, for many of us in the West, more often than any other part that's left out, is our physical experience, the experiences of our body, being in our body. And that's various reasons. One of them, which is very prevalent, is we're often too busy. The body is the last thing we want to pay attention to because we're running around taking care of, trying to fit in as much as we possibly can in a busy day. And as we hurry and rush through our life, our priorities is ahead of us in taking care of things and getting things done and getting places on time. And our body then suffers. The body's kind of left behind, in a sense, to kind of try to rush and keep up. But we don't really pay attention. We don't attend to our body. We don't give the body its due, in a sense. So sometimes we're too busy. Another reason for not paying attention to the physical half of our life is we often flee pain and discomfort. The body is where we experience a lot of our discomfort and pain in the life, both our psychological. And one way to avoid both psychological and physical and interpersonal pain, one way to avoid it is to numb out the body, to shut it off. And it's quite common for some people when they come to starting to do a meditation practice, is they discover that they're out of touch with certain parts of their body or huge parts of their body. And part of the process of meditation is rediscovering, reawakening the parts of their body which have become numb, they become separate from. And this involves a big deal of what it involves is a willingness to be present for that within us and around us. And some people who come to spiritual practice expect that it to be should be only be pleasant. After all, it's spiritual, right? But it isn't. It's spiritual practice is neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's opening to what is true. And some of what is happening within us is painful. Maybe the third reason for avoiding our body is for cultural or family or social kind of religious trainings that some of us have gotten, that the body is not a place to be. And the body should be discounted. The body maybe is impure, defiled. The spiritual, which is, you know, removed from the body, is where it's at. The mind is where it's at. Discounting of the body, the value of the body. My understanding of Buddhist spirituality is that you cannot wake up, you cannot become enlightened, you cannot become free, unless your body becomes awakened also. And we put such emphasis on the mind and on ideas and understandings and pushing our minds to certain levels and developing the mind. But if we don't drop down into our body, include our body as part of that process, I don't think an awakening will happen. We don't become any freer. And so if we discount the body as being, well, that's kind of mundane, that's the physical part of our life, it doesn't really count. The body is not just a physical phenomenon. The body, the mind is the body. Probably in Western parlance, some people would say, the body is the soul. The soul is the body. You can't separate them. Now, one of the interesting things that happens is that when parts of ourselves is split off from the whole, if our body split off from our mind, if our parts of our mind split off from our body, parts of some of our emotions, some of our feelings, some of our memories get split off. They often come back, that part of ourselves tries to compensate in some way, tries to come back in other ways. Often in unhealthy ways, ways that continue to fragment us. So, for example, if some people are afraid of being in relationships, and so they become strangers to others, but in the process they often become strangers to themselves, and so there's a pain there, and they don't want to look at the pain. And so they ignore, they cut off that part of their life, the pain of alienation. That pain of alienation, that longing that might be there, still operating. And so maybe more unconsciously in a sense. And maybe then you try to fill that pain with maybe alcohol or some addiction or something else. But the pain or the addiction is often a maladaptive attempt to try to satisfy or soothe or fill out the physical sense of who we are, bring physical comfort, that's only temporary and actually often continues the process of increased alienation from ourselves. So the idea of splitting off part of ourselves from our body can end to kind of spiraling where things actually get worse if we don't bring some careful attention to it. And this perhaps is understood in the Buddhist tradition by another list, which maybe is nice to think of as being kind of parallel to the four foods. And this is a very important list for Buddhism. The four foods is kind of like a minor list. But this next one is called the four outflows, or the four drains, or the four leaks. And it's the Pali word is asavas. And in the description of the Buddha's enlightenment, now that should, you know, be an interesting thing to study. The key thing that happens to him, the key turning point, is the elimination of these asavas, these leaks, these drains, these things that drain us, these outflows. So the understanding is that some things support life and nourish our life, and some things will actually drain our life, drain the energy and the life force from us. And so the Buddha gave us a list of these four drains. The first is craving for sense pleasure. So here we have the interesting, on one hand, sense impressions can feed us. On the other hand, they can also drain us through the craving for craving. The second is craving, the literal word is more like craving for being. And this means craving to be someone, craving for an identity. The third is craving for opinions, for being right. If you insist on being right, you might get tired. It's a drain. If not on you, then for others. And the fourth is very interesting also. It's craving for ignorance. Some people, that's where their addiction goes. They crave not paying attention. To not pay attention to certain parts of ourselves, certain parts of our experience. These four movements fragment us or drain us. And perhaps if the Buddha was, you know, a modern Vipassana teacher who was trained in psychology, he would have said it not for craving, not he's craving for sense pleasure, but he would have used the word addiction. Because it seems to work very well. Part of what addiction does is it feeds the surface, in a sense, of who we are, and not the depths of what we really are. And perhaps the emphasis on the four foods is to try to understand how to feed the depths of who we are that's below the egotistical self, the self-centered self. And an aspect of practice of a Buddhist spiritual life is to learn how to feed ourselves. And the medium for nourishment, the medium for this food, is awareness itself, is attention, calm attention. To allow a calm attention. Calm doesn't mean you have to do things slowly, but it means calm presence that allows the food to come and nourish us and impact on us in a way that's supportive rather than a way that's draining. And it requires attention, requires awareness. So this is what this is what in mindfulness training practice we're doing. We're training our awareness. We're developing our awareness. And it's really marvelous what awareness practice can do. One of the things it does is it gives you another option of how to respond to a situation. If you find yourself in a situation, you're unsure of how to respond or what's going on or unsure about maybe your emotions are kind of coloring your perception of what's going on or your response. One of the options we have always is to pay attention. And for some people, that's a radical teaching. What do you mean? Just stop and pay attention to what's going on here, to bring awareness to it. But anyway, awareness is the medium through which these foods come into our system. So the first is edible foods. And there's a famous quote by Martha Graham. There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block, it will never exist through any other medium and will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, or how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. If you do not even have to believe in yourself or your work, you have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channels open. It's really precious to be born as a human being. It's really a marvelous thing. And that marvelous move blossoms in the context of awareness. So how do we feed ourselves in a way, literally, in a way that supports openness, compassion, awareness? I know that I've eaten myself in my younger days into numbness. I've eaten so much that I've kind of numbed out in certain situations. Sometimes I've ingested things in my body that I knew were basically poisonous. And I can remember back, it's the motivation. It was kind of neurotic and I was feeling insecure. And that's why my insecurity, I ate. It was a great way to do that. It actually was terrible spiral for me because I developed an allergy to wheat for about 7 years. And so when I was feeling kind of lousy, I would want to kind of nourish myself, want to kind of soothe myself. And so I would eat bread. And I'd feel worse. And then I didn't know I had an allergy yet. And so what do I do? Well, if I felt bad, I'd eat more bread. And I'd feel worse, and then I'd eat more bread. Until I remember walking around San Francisco just like institutionalized just completely in days. No idea what was going on. And so there was, there was an interaction between the allergy and, you know, my craving, but it was very very explicit lesson. To eat the amounts and the quality of food which encourage and helps us to feel good about ourselves, to feel good about presence. As I get older, I see, maybe it's a symptom of getting older. I don't eat as much as I used to, maybe that's why. But it's more important to me what I eat than I used to eat. And it's, I can feel it has a bigger impact on me. So the quality of what I eat has a big impact I'm careful with now. And we feed more than just, you know, it's food, literal edible food is more than just physical nutriment. It can provide other wonderful qualities. And, you know, if it's a food is well prepared and well delivered, and you can feel, it's kind of nourishing to feel the sense of care that went into it. That someone, even yourself, when you're cooking for yourself, there's a sense of care and concern and compassion and simplicity and presence that you can feel sometimes in the way that food is prepared. And to sit down at a meal and to feel that is really a delight. You see it very clearly in Japanese aesthetics. Japanese aesthetics, it seems that when they have these beautifully arranged, simple Japanese trays with food, there's never enough to satisfy you physically. But something else gets very deeply satisfied. And it's interesting that Buddha designed monastic life for his monks and nuns. The rules around eating were designed so that the amount of food would be adequate, but not excessive. The idea of not eating, at least that was the ideal behind it. The second food is the sense impressions, the sensations we receive in the world around us and within us. And not only, you know, do we eat foods, but in a sense, the eyes eat, the ears eat, the body eats, in terms of receiving impressions, and they affect us and impact us. And remember that the same thing can either drain us or feed us. The sense impressions can drain us or they can feed us. And to notice what the difference is part of the discriminating wisdom that comes with practice. Attention to our body and our senses. And again, the tremendous importance of dropping down into the body and this experiencing. You don't experience as your senses unless you're in your body, unless awareness is in your body. And there's nothing in Buddhism that says that the senses, the sense experiences are bad. What's bad is craving them and indulging in them in kind of egotistical ways or in harmful ways. But simply being open to them, enjoying the senses, can actually be a wonderful... at times can rejuvenate a person. But I don't think it's so much the sense experience. The Buddha said it's one of the foods. I'm suspect it's more giving ourselves a chance to be aware again. It's the careful awareness or the open awareness, the calm awareness of that, that what makes it nourishing, not necessarily particular sensations. And it's kind of like the principle, you know, that young children, as they're growing up, part of the developmental need is to receive attention. And if they don't receive, it's one of the great sufferings that people have in life, is not to receive attention as children, not to be seen or heard. And as adults, in a sense, that need for attention still is. And so we feed ourselves by bringing attention to the ways in which we experience the world. To have enough presence to feel, to sense the world, to experience the world through our senses, rather than only through our thoughts and our concepts and ideas. So, to sense our way into the world, to yield ourselves to feel the felt experience of being alive, not the conceptual ideas of being alive, feeds us and supports us. And dropping down into the body, sensing our life through our body, is actually a way of healing the split between the body, the mind, the different fragmentations that we have of who we think we are. I think that Freud didn't get it quite right. Freud or Jung, who said, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. I think much more so is the body. The body is the royal road to the unconscious. The dreams are kind of like the back door. So in Buddhism, there's also this teaching called guarding the sense doors, which you don't hear about very much in the West. It's kind of unpopular Dharma circles, guarding the sense doors. But this is maybe not something so strange. It's simply bringing attention, allowing ourselves to rest in the experiences of the senses, what goes on there, so we can make wise choices about how we relate to the sense experiences. To experience and feel the delight. You know, you're driving down the road and you see this beautiful BMW, you know, sports car. You know, a nice blue color. And it's just beautiful shape. And has kind of old, I saw it today, you know, it has this kind of old, it looked like it was kind of designed out of some old car from the 30s or something. And has this nice little gill. You know, and it was a convertible and it was nice blue. It was kind of really shiny and nice kind of, it was really beautiful. And I could enjoy it. And I could crave it. And one way is kind of nourishing. It's kind of nice. I mean, I have all kinds of opinions about expensive sport cars, but aside from my opinions, the in and of itself, it was kind of beautiful, artistic, I thought. So I could just enjoy it and receive the nice impressions, and it was kind of nourishing. Or I could get, you know, into planning and, you know, I should be having this and. You know, and how can I? Maybe I chose the wrong profession, and and pretty soon I'm not enjoying the car anymore, because I'm in my, you know, my plans about a second career. And a friend of mine who's in his 80s had this dramatic realization recently. That he spent his life paying attention to the way instead of paying attention to the way things are. What a difference! And a lot of what Buddhist practice is about is training ourselves to be with the way things are, rather than the way we want them to be or the way we don't want them to be, or you know. And you know, it hurts to watch other people misuse their sense impressions, misuse their senses, and consume kind of harmful things. To watch people smoke, for me, or overeat, or to watch endless TV that's numbing. Watch in some ways, just kind of feel. I feel the pain that must be in that body that's doing that. I want to be careful to say that around people who, you know, are smoking or whatever, because. You know, it's a complicated event, what's going on. And so in Buddhism, we have this teaching of the hungry ghosts. Hungry ghost is when we split off part of ourselves, and then it comes back in this form of a hungry ghost, of great craving or addiction. And part of the art of practice is learning how to feed the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts can't be fed. They have these properly. Regular food, because they have these very, 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 very thin necks, thinner than a straw, and these huge, 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 huge mouths, like bigger than an elephant, bigger than a... And so it can't consume, it can't take in as much food. And it also has huge, huge stomach, big, 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 big stomach. But the thing is, it has a really small, small neck, so it just can't get enough food down the neck to fill this big stomach. So it's always craving more and more and more. And the art is how to feed that. And part of how to feed it is to feel the pain. And if we don't feel the pain of our hungry ghosts, we won't feed it. Feeling the pain, like little kids, right? Our pain sometimes like little kids, and what it wants is our attention. If we turn away from our pain, we don't feed it in a healthy way. And then the third food is intentions. And I feel that a lot of what Buddhist practice is about, there's many things it's about, but one way to talk about it is it's to clarify and purify and strengthen and express our deepest intentions. To find out what our intentions are. Sometimes it takes a long time, our deepest intention. There's a huge difference between the wanting mind and the intending mind. And you can kind of feel kind of the difference between the two words, I think, the two expressions. The wanting mind, it can often obscure the present moment. The intending mind, the intending heart, for me, it's a much more holistic thing that your whole body participates. It's kind of deeper, more integral, has more integrity to it. And we intend, and intention arises out of us, but it's not something we're controlled by. It's not something we have to do. I see that wonderful BMW sports car, and if I want it, the wanting mind can take over, and I'm thinking about new jobs in Silicon Valley, and how to listen, and ask for a job, and you know, and you get lost. But the intending mind, I don't think you get lost in that. I think the intending mind has, in my sense, my feeling of it is that it's kind of a rooted, grounded experience from which we you know, can choose wisely how to respond to it, how to act on it. So there's a difference between doing what you want and doing what you intend. There was a very dramatic interview with Dennis Rodham in the paper. I guess it was an article about this book that his ex-wife has written. They interviewed him, and he said the statement. You know, he did this famous thing on the basketball court this year, of butting a coach with his head, I guess. And then he explained afterwards that he was just expressing himself. It was important for him to have the freedom to do what he wants and express himself freely. It seemed kind of a misunderstood idea of self-expression. And it's very, you know, it's to me, I don't know what was behind his statement, what he really intending behind it. But there's a tendency, I think, for some people to confuse our deepest intentions. And our wants are often neurotic. And then to have some manifesto that says, you know, I deserve whatever I want, get out of my way, is very, you know, causes a lot of suffering. Our intentions lead us to ever deepening experience of our life, ever more holistic experience of our life. Our intentions do. We find our intentions and explore them and open to them and feel them. Anything opens to something deeper within us. But our intentions to pay attention, our intentions to be kind, our intentions to be compassionate, our intentions to be helpful, our intentions to be nourish ourselves, be good neighbors. So all kinds of wonderful intentions. And Buddha, in a sense, you know, since Buddhism has taken away the self for us, the only thing that Buddhism leaves us with is as anything that qualifies as the self is our intentions. It's our choices we make. And one of the things that we become aware of as we can develop our mindfulness is that we become aware of a wider range of choices that we have in our life. A person who's unaware has very few choices. A person who's aware has greater range of choices. And there's also a greater range of freedom possible. It's a wonderful way in which turning into our senses, training our senses, training to be aware of in our body, actually leads us to a world of greater choice, of greater awareness, of greater sense of what our deepest intentions are. Because for me, personally, my deepest intentions arise out of my body. And if I'm not in touch with my body, I'm not in touch with my deepest intentions. If I'm living in my mind, rushing around, doing all these things I have to do, and arranging things and doing everything, it's like I'm acting on a past intention, and I've gotten caught by it and doing all these things. If I'm in touch with my intention, my deep intention, I'm still in touch with my body because it's in my body that it wells up from. That's my sense of how it is. And I think that I suspect that all effective spiritual practice helps us to find a deeper place of response, of making choices, than we have if we're simply oscillating between the poles of self-importance and self-abasement, conceit and unworthiness, fear and bravado, and things like that. The beauty about this idea, teaching of no, is when we drop our self-consciousness, that it allows for, you know, some deeper movement to happen from within us. Sometimes I think of mindfulness practice as being like Aikido. I don't know much about Aikido. So don't, take me too seriously. But idea I have about Aikido is, I've never done Aikido. But the idea I have is that you kind of turn into the body of the opponent. And then weight and the energy of the opponent to kind of, make the situation better. My father did Aikido when I was a kid, and he said you were being trained to love your opponent to defeat, defeat your opponent with love, or something like that. That's what he was being taught. So, but you turn into your opponent, and I think it's the same thing with our life. That which is difficult, and that which is painful, that which is beautiful and nice, we turn into the body of it. We turn into the felt sense of it. Everything has a felt sense in the body. And it's really wonderful to turn into that, yield into it, rest into it. So if the wanting mind is there, instead of the intending mind, don't deny it, don't push it away, but do a little bit of Aikido. Yield yourself into it. Don't give into it, don't do it, if it's kind of neurotic wanting. But turn into it and turn into what its felt sense of that wanting is like. And you might find that you bring a kind of love or care, or something else might happen if you allow yourself to really feel it rather than to dismiss it or act on it. Wanting. For some reason, I'm not sure why anymore, but I have in my notes an example. The quest for power. The quest for power often allays insecurity, personal insecurity, distress, loneliness. And to attain some kind of level of power, I think, is always ephemeral and impermanent. So that it becomes something necessary to constantly chase after and constantly try to prop up. It's much more powerful, much more healing to do some Aikido with the desire for power and turn into the felt sense of insecurity, the felt sense of longing or wanting, and see what happens. Discover what's deeper if you turn into it. If you turn away from it, you won't discover anything deeper. And the fourth food is consciousness. And maybe it's just another way of saying awareness. But consciousness becomes a food. I don't quite understand how this is a food. Clearly, awareness is a food. If we bring careful awareness to our experience, that awareness supports and clarifies and cleans up and vitalizes our life. But consciousness becomes a food when consciousness doesn't grasp anything or fixate anywhere. Consciousness which doesn't fixate, doesn't hold on to something, doesn't grasp, is nourishing. I was reminded recently of when the symphony, and I hadn't been to the symphony for a long time. So it's kind of, all these new sights and stuff. And the first, when I first got there, I wasn't paying attention to any of the music because it was just all this news. The composer, the conductor was up there doing his thing, and I was judging the conductor for doing his thing. And then there was the violinist there and this. I was watching everybody and commenting and wondering and how did all this work and thinking about it all, and I didn't hear sound of the music. So I said, well, this is not, I didn't come here to not listen. So I closed my eyes, and it took some more attention. I could hear the music, and that was nice. And but it took some work, you know. Still, my mind was kind of busy, but slowly, you know, it kind of I settled in and relaxed, and was more present. And then at some point during the second half, I could open my eyes and listen at the same time. Because at this point, my consciousness, my awareness wasn't grasping on something. It wasn't settling on some particular point of the experience and going off and thinking about it. I could see everything. I could see, you know, I could see the sights and the conductor and all the people in the orchestra and doing their thing, and I could hear the music. And it was a whole. The visual and the visual and oral experience were all a whole, beautiful whole. It was really delightful. Because my consciousness, my awareness, was not grasping or settling on any one place. And including that, was part of that whole was also my thoughts and concerns, what was going on, my comments and all that. It was all there. But my mind was free from latching onto anything, so it could flow with the music, in a sense. And awareness and consciousness, awareness is not a territory we go into or out of. It's perhaps... one point of view is that it's something that's always here. It's a territory we're always in. It's not something we create. In a sense, consciousness is very strange in what it is. I don't know what it is. But it's kind of like pure space in which all our thoughts and feelings and experiences kind of flow through. Consciousness without a self. Consciousness without self-consciousness. Consciousness without divisions. The problem with the attachments to self is it divides the world. And when our self-consciousness drops away, there's an experience more complete. I wanted to give you an exercise. You might try in your practice. In mindfulness practice, we often focus on what we're paying attention to, the things that we're aware of. But sometimes in your practice, it's useful to turn the mirror of mindfulness back on the mindfulness itself. Turn the attention back on the quality of the awareness with which you're paying attention. And what you might find is that the divisions of the mind, the attachments of the mind, the attachments in consciousness, the places we grasp, can be felt sometimes in the quality of the attention we bring to the present moment. And so by turning attention back on the nature of attention itself, you can feel where the holding is. And then if you feel it, then there's a chance of opening something larger. I hope that made sense. If not, don't worry about it. So this is one of my favorite little poems by Ryokan. This is from the point of view of the experience of a holy experience of having no divisions. No divisions, no self-conscious divisions. With no mind, blossoms invite the butterfly. With no mind, the butterfly visits the blossoms. When the flower blooms, the butterfly comes. When the butterfly comes, the flower blooms. I do not know others. Others do not know me. Not knowing each other, we naturally follow the way. So I hope you all get it. And mostly it means giving yourself a chance to calmly be aware of what your life is as it's happening.